Vicky Strong, thanks for listening to VOA 1 The Hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is made for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dan Friedel talks about more than $2 billion donated to organizations, including colleges. Dr. Jill Robbins talks about astronauts in space and how they clean their clothes. I will return with this week's words and their stories. Today, I explain the expression, preaching to the choir. Then, we will finish our 30 minutes together with our series on America's presidents, written and hosted by Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, here is Dan Friedel with the education report.
Mackenzie Scott, the former wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, recently donated over $2 billion to hundreds of organizations, including colleges and universities. She is one of the wealthiest women in the world. Even with the donation, she still has over $60 billion. Scott wrote about her decision to donate the money on Medium. She said she wanted to give money to organizations that can help people who are underfunded and overlooked. Some of the organizations support arts and culture. Many of them support local education. For example, one organization, Achieving the Dream, works to help community college students in 45 states enter school and finish their degrees. Another organization, Jazz at Lincoln Center, is run by Wynton Marsalis, a member of a famous musical family. Its mission is to teach people about jazz music, educate music students, and celebrate personal freedom. However, a major part of Scott's money went to higher education, schools both large and small. For example, large universities in Florida and Texas each received $40 million. Overall, about 30 colleges and universities received money. A number of community colleges received millions of dollars each. They are two-year schools that often serve as a bridge between high school and four-year colleges. They also teach people career skills, like how to be a nurse or how to protect computer networks. Martha Parham is a spokeswoman for the American Association of Community Colleges. The colleges her organization represents serve almost 12 million students each year. She said about 30% of the students are the first in their families to attend college. Most community colleges operate with very small budgets. Money generally comes from state governments, local taxes, and students paying for their classes. a large donation from someone like Scott is rare. Community colleges are not heavy hitters in terms of philanthropic donations, Parham said. These donations from Mackenzie Scott are, in most cases, the largest donations these colleges have ever received. College of the Desert is a community college near Palm Springs, California. It has about 16,000 students. Scott donated $18 million. In a statement, the college president, Jeff Baker, said the money will go to a program that helps local high school graduates attend school without being charged for 2 years. Baker said the donation will help the program stay active for many years without asking for donations. He said the program will now be never-ending. Parham said the donation from Scott is the second big news story of 2021 to call attention to community colleges. The other is that Jill Biden, the First Lady, is a community college professor.
We're extremely proud of what the community colleges do and are thrilled that they're being recognized for the role that they serve as that on-ramp to the middle class for millions of Americans.
Scott and Bezos divorced in 2019. She left the marriage, owning 4% of Amazon. Her wealth increased as the value of Amazon grew. She joined The Giving Pledge, along with Warren Buffett and Bill and Melinda Gates. They are all among the richest people in the world. They plan to give away most of their money. Since 2020, Scott has given away almost $10 billion. Last year, she gave away about $6 billion. In that donation, she chose several colleges and universities founded by Black people with the goal of providing African Americans with high-quality college educations. The schools are known as historically Black colleges and universities. Scott gave money to Howard University, Hampton University, Tuskegee University, and many others. She also gave money to organizations that help feed hungry people and others that were helping people struggling during the COVID-19 pandemic. Scott's most recent gift allows the organizations to spend the money however they choose. Scott wrote that higher education is a proven pathway to opportunity, and she wanted to give money to schools that help people from chronically underserved communities. I'm Dan Friedel.
Thanks, Dan. Next, let's go into space with Dr. Jill Robbins as she explains how astronauts handle a common household duty, cleaning clothes.
Have you ever wondered how astronauts clean their clothes in space? You may find the answer surprising. They do not. They wear their underclothes and everything else until they cannot take the dirt and smell anymore. Then they throw them away. NASA wants to change that. If not at the International Space Station, or ISS, then the Moon and Mars. This would mean the end to throwing away lots of dirty clothes every year. Up to now, they simply had to put them with other waste in old supply ships to burn up in the atmosphere. NASA is working with the U.S. company Procter & Gamble, or P&G, to learn how best to clean astronauts' clothes in space. They could use the clothes for months or even years, just like on Earth. P&G announced Tuesday that it will send Tide detergent and dirt removal experiments to the space station later this year and next year. The battle against dirty and sweaty clothes in space has begun. It is not a small problem, especially as the U.S. and other countries plan to establish bases on the Moon and Mars. NASA says rocket storage space is small and costly. So why waste it on new clothes if they could keep their old clothes looking and smelling fresh? An astronaut needs 68 kilograms of clothes in space per year. Mark Civic is a chemist specializing in fabric and home care technology for P&G. The clothes would use a lot of storage space, especially on a 3-year Mars mission, he said. There are also the problems of health and comfort. Space station astronauts exercise 2 hours every day to fight the effects of weightlessness on their bodies. That quickly leaves their workout clothes sweaty, smelly, and stiff. Leland Melvin is a former NASA astronaut and NFL player. He says their exercise clothing becomes so unpleasant that they use a new set every week. After that, they're deemed toxic, said Melvin, who serves as a spokesperson for P&G's project. They, like, have a life of their own. They're so stiff from all that sweat. While NASA and the other space station partners have researched ways to lengthen wear time with special antimicrobial clothes, that is not a long-term solution. In its first experiment, P&G will send up detergent made just for space in December. Scientists will then see how the compounds in the detergent react to 6 months of weightlessness. Next May, they will send stain removal pens and cloths to the ISS for testing by astronauts. At the same time, P&G is developing a washer-dryer machine that could operate on the Moon or even Mars. It would use small amounts of water and detergent. Such a machine could also be useful in dry places here on Earth. One of the many design problems is that the washing water would need to be reclaimed for drinking and cooking. This is done now with human liquid waste and sweat on the space station. The best solutions come from the most diverse teams, Melvin said. And how more diverse can you be than Tide and NASA? I'm Jill Robbins.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. Today, we talk about a type of shared belief. Often in our lives, we come together with others because of a shared belief or purpose. That group can sometimes be called a choir. A choir can describe a group of instruments of the same type. For example, a brass choir. A choir can be used to describe an organized group of persons or things. For example, many rich, famous people travel with a choir of assistants. A choir is also a group of organized singers in a church. This is the most common definition. For today's expression, we will focus on the church choir. The expression is preaching to the choir. Church leaders preach. That's why they're called preachers. But the word preach is not only used in a church. You can preach about something you believe to be good or necessary. However, people who preach to others speak to them in an annoying way about the right way to behave. They may sound as if they think they know better. And books that try to teach a moral lesson could be criticized for being too preachy. But now let's get back to our expression, preaching to the choir. One online dictionary gives this definition. If I am preaching to the choir, I am presenting an argument or opinion to people who already agree with it. So I am not looking to convince them. Perhaps I am just looking to feel good about my idea. When you preach to the choir, you are sharing your opinion with people who already agree with you. They are already on your side. You don't need to convince them. So sometimes it means you are wasting your breath, like in this example.
You know, we need a park in our neighborhood.
I couldn't agree more.
The empty property at the end of the street would be perfect, and it's near the woods, so it'll be very quiet.
You don't have to sell me on your idea. I brought up that same idea years ago.
It would be great not just for the kids, but for everyone. It could be a gathering place and a place for community activities.
I already know all this. Now you're just preaching to the choir. What you need to do is to talk to all the other neighbors on this street and get them on board. A few were against the idea years ago.
Here is another example. If I said to you that learning another language can be good for you in so many ways, and you should try it, you could say, Anna, you are preaching to the choir. We're already doing that. And that's all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Grover Cleveland. When Americans remember him, it is mostly because he makes writing presidential timelines difficult. Cleveland was the nation's 22nd president, and also its 24th. He remains the only U.S. president to date whose second term did not immediately follow the first. Cleveland is also notable because of his personal life and because he held office during one of the country's worst economic crises. Thank you. Stephen Grover Cleveland was born in the northeastern state of New Jersey and grew up mostly in New York. He was a middle child in a family of 9 children. His father was a minister, and the family did not have much money. As a result, Cleveland had little formal education. He was one of the few presidents who did not go to college. But he was able to become a lawyer. He earned enough money and developed a good professional image. In time, he became a sheriff, a mayor, and the governor of the state of New York. In his early life, Cleveland did not marry and have children. Instead, he had many friends with whom he enjoyed hunting, fishing, and eating and drinking in restaurants. But Cleveland did have a relationship with a widow named Maria Halpin. She became pregnant and said Cleveland was the baby's father. Cleveland said he was not sure if he was. However, he gave the child some financial support, the name of one of his closest friends, and his own family name. The child was called Oscar Folsom Cleveland. Shortly after the boy was born, his mother was sent to an institution for the mentally unstable. Doctors quickly confirmed that her mental health was fine, but her son was taken from her and raised by another family. The story about Halpin and the child became an issue in the election of 1884. The Democratic Party had nominated Cleveland as their candidate for president. In general, voters liked his message of limiting federal spending, reducing the power of wealthy interests, and stopping political corruption. Some called him Grover the Good. But Cleveland's opponents said his history with Maria Halpin showed that he was an immoral man. At anti-Cleveland rallies, Republicans chanted, "Ma, Ma, where's my Pa?" Pa is another word for father. But Cleveland did not comment much on the matter. His defenders said Cleveland's honesty as a public official was more important than his bad judgment as a private citizen. Voters seemed to agree. Cleveland narrowly won the election. His supporters answered the Republicans' chants of "Where's my Pa?" by saying, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." Grover Cleveland's presidency was unusual because he did not want to use the office to propose laws. Instead, he mostly aimed to keep the federal government operating efficiently. He also wanted to limit lawmakers' power to help special interest groups. As a result, Cleveland vetoed many bills in his first term. He set a record at that time for saying no to proposals from Congress. One of the few ideas that he supported was reducing tariffs. Many of his fellow Democrats liked that idea too, but a number of Republicans did not. In the next election, their candidate, Benjamin Harrison, defeated Cleveland. Cleveland returned to being a lawyer in New York. In 1892, Cleveland was chosen to run against Benjamin Harrison again. The tariff issue returned. The Republicans' protective tariffs had hurt some industries, and voters answered this time by voting Harrison out of office. Cleveland returned to the White House, but this time he was not alone. Two years into his first term as president, Cleveland married the daughter of his close friend, Oscar Folsom. The bride's name was Frances Folsom. She was 21 years old at the time. The president was 49. Cleveland was not the first president to get married while in office, but he was the first one to be married in the White House. The event captivated the public. What's more, Americans adored the new First Lady. She was known for being social, charming, and beautiful. Historians conclude that she was the most popular First Lady since Dolly Madison. She remains the youngest. When the Clevelands returned to the White House, the country was entering a severe economic recession. Some of the country's biggest businesses were failing, including a railroad and many banks. As a result, investors withdrew their money from the stock market. The withdrawal caused many other businesses to fail. This series of events is known as the Panic of 1893. Soon, more and more Americans were out of work. Many could not afford houses or food. Some begged President Cleveland to intervene, but he declined. He did not think it was the role of the federal government to create jobs in order to reverse the Depression. However, Cleveland did use the power of the federal government to intervene during a famous labor strike. In that event, workers in Chicago who helped keep the trains operating walked out of their jobs. They were protesting a major decrease in their pay that did not include a decrease in their living expenses. Since the owner of the company also controlled the price of housing and food, workers appealed to him to treat them more fairly. But the company owner refused even to meet with the workers. Soon, the workers' boycott grew. Workers at other rail yards stopped working. Farmers could not get their goods to market, and others could not get the supplies they needed. Even the mail stopped being delivered. So Cleveland sent federal troops to break the strike. In the short term, Cleveland's actions worked. The trains moved again, and both the courts and most of the public agreed with the president's decision. But in the long term, Cleveland's handling of the panic, depression, and workers' strike lost the support of many voters. At the next opportunity, they voted him out of the White House again. Cleveland returned to New York and later settled in a large house in Princeton, New Jersey. There, he wrote, made speeches, sat on corporate boards, became a trustee of Princeton University, and enjoyed the respect of the people who lived in the town. He died at age 71 of problems with his stomach, heart, and kidneys. Several people said his final words were, "I have tried so hard to do right." Then and now, many people agreed with that idea. Cleveland was generally an honest man who worked hard and tried to act independently as president. But he is not considered one of America's best leaders. He did not have a clear idea about how to guide the country. Yet the opposing party, at least, may have considered Cleveland's presidency a success. After Cleveland's final election defeat, six of the next seven presidents were Republicans. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.